Hello, everyone. Welcome. I'm Carrie L., and this is Carrie L.'s Heartlink Show. And as I connect to as many hearts as possible, we are creating more freedom, light, and love, one interview at a time. I will be bringing you programs that are for the great awakening that is underway on planet Earth as we approach 2012. And I'll be keeping you abreast of the latest tools available for anchoring a greater and healthier reality into your life. I'll be interviewing cutting-edge experts in the metaphysical, scientific, paranormal, and spiritual. Stay tuned for the next hour as I speak with a fascinating historian, someone who I've been looking forward to, who knows all about Ian Fleming and the James Bond Code, and that is Philip Gardner. So I look forward to that in a moment, and you can call in at the bottom of the hour if you would like to. We have 800 numbers right there on the internet for that. And so for now, I want you to just take a deep breath and relax and allow sacred love to flow through you. In the blessing of the day comes from the Gayatri Prayer. Let us focus on that effulgent light from which the whole universe is projected. May this inner sun enlighten our minds and hearts. And may we awaken as that light. And I want to just mention that you can go to my personal website, that's heartlinkinstitute.com, and find out about what I do. I am a transpersonal counselor and educator, and I have classes at the Institute as well as online. And they are classes in the esoteric, which we will be talking about today. So you might want to check into that. And I also have the Crop Circle cards, which is an oracle. And it's using, of course, the crop circles, their designs. And you can read about that and purchase that at heartlinkinstitute.com. And without further ado, I want to introduce my guest today, and that's Philip Gardner, who is going to take us on a journey into the heart of the world of secrets. And he's written his latest book, The Bond Code. He is an award-winning documentary maker and an international bestseller who has numerous books, and I've enjoyed some of them, actually. As well as The Bond Code. I'll mention some. Gnosis, The Secret of Solomon's Temple Revealed, The Serpent Grail, Secrets of the Serpent, I love that one, and Secret Societies, and The Ark of the Shroud and Mary. So he lectures around the world. He is internationally famous. So I'm so excited to have this prolific author and historian. Welcome, Philip. How are you?
Thank you very much for having me on. I'll pay you later.
Okay. All right. One of those, huh? Okay. I know you're in the UK, and I'm just so honored to have you on our show, and I know you've been traveling a lot, and you've been doing documentaries, and I want to go into all of it. So why don't you just go ahead and start off and tell us, first of all, about yourself?
Oh, that's never easy for somebody who's modest like me. But I write books. I've been doing so for around about 5 years. It's not a long time, but in those 5 years, I've basically lost count how many I've written now and how many films I've made. I used to run a marketing business, and like a great many people in marketing, I came to the realization through reading history and propaganda, which is part of marketing, obviously, that I was part and parcel of a great big scam. So I decided, I sold the company, I left it behind, and decided to take the knowledge of that propaganda matrix that we're all part of, that we all jump onto this hamster's wheel, and try to free some minds. And right now, the reason that the bond code has been done is because that is more mainstream. So I can use a mainstream device such as James Bond to get through to more people than just writing books about hugging crystals and trees. So that's the way that I'm going, and using the information and knowledge that I've built over the years doing marketing degrees and various other things for a greater enlightenment. So that's basically me. I've just come back from Kentucky, where I went on. I was invited to be the skeptic, the debunker on a Bigfoot documentary, and it was actually me who ended up diving at very, very large, strange things that were running past us in the woods. So that's going to be an incredible documentary.
Wow.
In a couple of months, I'll be flying off to Norway to film... Sorry?
Can I interrupt just for a minute? Are you saying that you saw Bigfoot?
We've got an awful lot of stuff on footage. We've got strange lights. We've got the very sound, the scream, which was no further than about 6 feet away from us, and it scared everybody witless. And we went down into the woods, a couple of us who weren't scared, and we followed it down a pathway, and basically not scared of it because it is part of nature, and so am I, and I will express and give off that frequency of no fear and no aggression towards any beast. And because of that, I think that that's the reason it came very, very close to us. And I've had similar experiences recently when I was in Australia. I walked outside having a cup of tea in the morning, and no further than 2 feet away from me was a big 7-foot kangaroo. And everybody inside the building was screaming, "Get back inside, Phil, it's gonna, you know, these things are dangerous." But I just spent a few moments just, you know, talking to it silently, if you know what I mean. And I've had similar experiences in quite a lot of places, from, you know, scorpions up to this 8-foot shadow that walked past us the other week.
Scorpion, wow. An 8-foot scorpion. Now,
I
can only imagine.
No, it wasn't an 8-foot scorpion. Don't get me wrong, no. From scorpions to the 8-foot thing that walked past us in Kentucky.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe they were combining there. Well, it sounds like you are just a natural at invoking some very unusual energies.
Well, the point is, it's a very serious point, and it's one that you made right at the start, that we need to get in tune. And you know, this is the point of gnosis. This is the esoteric world that we're talking about. When you find the true self, you realize that true self is part of the thing that we have divided from ourselves, and we call it the universe. And that division is a nonsense. And in the book called Gateways to the Other World, I went through an awful lot of effort to point out that there are specific frequencies that science knows about that are natural frequencies and ratios that the human mind can get to in order to connect with nature. And I've talked to biologists recently in Kentucky with the biologist there. We spoke about it, and he completely agreed that there are these frequencies where we can connect to nature. That's the true self. That's when you become enlightened, because you suddenly realize that you are the energy of the entire universe.
I agree. And we can use the quantum field, and that is at our disposal anytime.
Totally.
We don't have to go anywhere. We can just connect to that.
Well, absolutely. The number of times I've said, you know, I may have been all over the world to discover things. I may have been, you know, to Jerusalem and various other places to find things for the books, but most of the time I could have found it staring in the mirror.
And you describe, well, you in your book, you do talk about that. You talk about all the things that you've written about in the past in your James Bond book. which I found wonderful. You kind of connected the dots there. And so let's just kind of gradually get into the Bond Code. And first of all, why did you write the Bond Code?
Well, apart from the fact that it was a very good idea to get this message across the mainstream, writing about orcs and grails and things will just attract people that are interested in orcs and grails. And they're people that are already interested in the esoteric. But I had no intentions, really, to start with, to write a Bond book. I just finished The Ark, The Shroud of Mary, and I wanted a rest, basically. And I never watched television, but since childhood, I've always been a James Bond fan. You know, I'm a bloke at the end of the day. There was a rerun of the Bond films on television, and Live and Let Die was on, so I sat down and watched it. It was probably the longest I've watched TV in years. But even then, my mind didn't start working, and anybody who's seen Live and Let Die will know that it's full of voodoo, that there are snakes, tarot cards, Baron Samedi, all kinds of things thrown in there. And it just set my mind racing to wonder whether Ian Fleming had put these into the Bond novels or whether this was just a film. And, you know, a year later, I wrote the Bond Code.
And why don't you tell us what you found out? Ian Fleming is an unusual character to begin with. He could write a story. Go ahead and tell us about his character himself. What was his problem?
Which one? To understand the Bond Code, you have to understand Ian Fleming. There's no other way of doing it. You know, you can sit here and say there's a Bond Code, and it can sound silly, but when you understand the background to Ian Fleming and what led him into that world, then it starts to make more sense. He was from a family, a very well-to-do family. His mother was of royal blood, had very close royal connections, and so there were royals that often visited the household. His father was a member of parliament, a war hero, and heir to an extremely powerful bank, which was sold not long ago for $7 billion. So this is a very powerful family. Ian Fleming grew up seeing the likes of Winston Churchill come over for tea. So this is not a usual family. His mother was a dominating lady, and his elder brother, Peter Fleming, was actually an international best-selling travel writer and war hero, and basically eclipsed everything that Ian Fleming did. So this was a lot for a young man to come up to equal, and he couldn't. So he went through a process that psychologists were discovering at that time with second children and even first children, that they have issues with siblings and that it causes inferiority complexes and divided natures within man. We're all divided in a way. We all have various extremes, or we're all somewhere on the spectrum of division. An easy way of putting that across is, for instance, when we deal with our husband or wife, we're very different to when we go down the pub and deal with our mates. There are two expressions of ourselves that come out there. So that's a slight element of the division. Ian Fleming had that very same thing, but in a much more caricatured way. It was much bigger and much more expressed. And so he failed, basically, in the schools in Great Britain, or as far as his mother was concerned, he failed. And so he was sent to Austria under the notion that he was going there to learn languages, where, in fact, he was going to deal with or learn from a couple of Adlerian psychoanalysts, named Forbes Dennises. And they dealt with this young man by teaching him ancient methods of psychology, which we know today as the esoteric, as gnosis and alchemy. And they sent him to a lecture given by Carl Jung, the famous psychoanalyst, who is very famous for pointing out and being the first man to point out that ancient gnosis was actually continued within alchemy, and that's what alchemy was really all about. And he sat there and listened to Carl Jung, and It was a lecture given on Paracelsus, the alchemist, and it struck a chord with Ian Fleming because he related to Paracelsus himself. And he actually asked Carl Jung if he could translate that lecture. And he got permission from the man himself. And I have a copy of that translation. It's for the very first time any Fleming biographer has actually tracked this down to Austin University in Texas. And been given permission to use it. So that is very revealing of the life of the early man. And it does show us that from very, very early on, he was not only interested in the world of the occult, the esoteric, but that he learned from the masters themselves. Carl Jung was a master of this. And that is a very, very big thing that people need to take on board, and why he then later on in life had the knowledge to include this code in his books.
It's amazing the way he used the occult in his books. Can you give us an example of how he, what were some of the symbolisms and codes that he was using?
Well, there are a great many. There is the main overarching code that you find in there, which is the Gnostic principle, or the alchemical wedding. It's the chemical wedding of the Rosicrucians, which is the union of the opposites. And what that is these, the two sides of the mind, the two sides of the self, must be united for a person to be fully developed. For instance, you must have logic and emotion, because to be fully emotional, you would basically be too emotional. You would not have no control over your emotions. And to be too logical, then you would just be hard and rigid, and you would not have any compassion. So you need to bring both of those sides of yourself into union. This is the chemical wedding, the union of the opposites, the positive male and the negative female. This is not any way saying that females are negative, it's just the expression used. So James Bond can never save the day, save the world, unless he comes into union with the Bond girl. That is throughout the books. And where he doesn't come into union with the Bond girl, he fails. So that's the overarching code, and that's a code that's been used for many, many centuries by many writers who are expressing esoteric truths, such as, for instance, the Arthur tale or the Robin Hood and Marian tale. Both of those are tales where the union of the opposites must come together in order for the nation, which is really the true self, to be to flourish. So there is that. And then, in addition to that, many of the names in the books have etymological codes. Ian Fleming, during the Second World War, was a naval intelligence officer involved in code breaking and black secret service operations, which are occult operations. And so he understood about codes and language and numerology. And he placed those in the books. So, for instance, you get characters such as Blofeld, who is Ernst Stavro Blofeld, which means to be earnest. And Blofeld means blue field, which is an allusion to his own blue blood. And he even gave Blofeld his own birthday. So he's expressing that the villain is really an element of himself that he must overcome. And the same with Scaramanga. Scaramanga means to masquerade. He is masquerading within the book. Auric Goldfinger. Auric is an alchemical term for gold. And Goldfinger is the name of somebody who plays around with the gold all day long. And we're known as cheats. And of course, Goldfinger was a cheat in the books and the film. He cheated at golf, he cheated at cards, etc. So he understood alchemy, and he understood what the terms meant, and he placed them in his books. Another one is the 007. Very, very interesting code, because it can mean several things. It is a number, as pointed out by one of Ian Fleming's friends and a spy, Richard Deacon, that the alchemist and spy of the 16th century, Dr. John Dee, used when writing to Queen Elizabeth. It is also a number that physicists discovered to be the bond that holds all things together, the number that is required for atoms to bond together. Discovered at the time Ian Fleming was writing these things, and he was a friend of Einstein, so he understood these concepts and collected books on them. If the ratio was 0.008, the entire universe would fly apart. And if it was 0.006, everything would crush back down into one single point. 0.007 is the ratio that is required for things to bond together. It's elements
it means
like
conscious.
That.
Excuse me, I'm
sorry.
It means consciousness. It is the number for consciousness and thought.
Oh, totally. I mean,
in numerology, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, seven is probably the most prime important number that there is in the esoteric world, as you obviously are aware.
It's interesting. It describes when I find out a person is a number seven in their birth number, that tells me a lot about how they operate. And they tend to be loners, actually. which would explain kind of his James Bond's mode of operation there. They're also very spiritual minded and they are very much thinkers.
Yes, absolutely. I'm a seven as well, by the way.
Well, not all sevens are the same. But
oh, I'm a loner. That's definite.
Well, you operate better when you can go your own way there and create things. They're marvelous. They're great manifestors. So, and it's a completion number spiritually.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the numbers that was given to him in "You Only Live Twice," which is a great Masonic ritual throughout the entire book of rebirth. He's given a new code, which is 7777, which is incredible numerology. And of course, you'll know that means, you know, it is done. It is, the resolution is complete.
Well, it adds up to 10 or 1, and that is the completion. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's also a resurrection. There's a resurrection.
Yes, absolutely. Which, of course, is what the book is about.
Isn't that interesting? Talk about that. What? You only live twice. You mentioned that was the especially prominent, the resurrection.
Well, this is the second to last book, and the last book that was published while he was alive. And he was obviously getting a little older and a little deeper. And he was writing these books in his wonderful spiritual location known as Goldeneye in Jamaica. And I think that he was getting a little deeper with this book, and Freemasons have since pointed out to me that, you know, they now recognize this to be the third degree. James Bond goes through, he's basically killed, and is then taken down to this submarine, or whale, and where he is then raised up again, very much like Jonah, Jesus, and you know, the whole mythos that goes around that. He's given a new name, which means firstborn dragon, which is, of course, intensely important to anybody who knows about alchemy and the esoteric world. Dragons and serpents are incredibly important, symbols of the energy and many other things. And he's given this new code, and he has to now set out as this new savior and yet again save the world. In that book, he also gives... has a child. Nothing is spoken of about this child ever again in any of the books, but it's in this book that the child is born. And, you know, in alchemy, this is giving birth to that that new self. It's a fantastic book, and if anybody wants to start and read a Bond novel and find the esoteric truth, then that's the one to go for.
Now, I find it interesting, you talked about why he used James Bond, the name James Bond, which is kind of a, you know, an average sort of name, but what's the symbolism in that?
Well, that is an interesting one, and Ian Fleming was very well known for obfuscating. He would often give several reasons for things that he's done. People would ask him a question and he would give them an answer, and then a week later somebody else would ask it and you get a different answer. This is, to me, it shouts volumes to me that he is hiding something when he does that. He knows full well why he's done something, and yet he is covering up. He is confusing. He's using all the tricks that he learned when he was in the Secret Service. James Bond, he gave several answers for, one of which was that it was the name of an ornithologist, a bird watcher, and an author on ornithology. But when you understand that Ian Fleming was involved in the world of the occult, that he had connections in Rosicrucianism, Freemasonry, and all the other things that we talked about, it would make sense that James Bond also means something else. And of course, in Live and Let Die, there's a moment when James Bond stops and looks in the voodoo window, and there is a tarot card depicting the twin pillars of the Temple of Solomon, famous to Freemasons as Joaz and Boakim. Get it right, Joachim and Boaz, I'm tired. And the initials of these, of course, are JB. And we're already highlighted to that fact by seeing a briefcase with the initials JB on, and then the next second we see JB on the pillars. And anybody who may have read, you know, Gnosis, the Secret of Solomon's Temple, will understand that these are the twin pillars you must pass through in order to enter the temple. You must do so in balance. You can't walk into one of those pillars because you'll hurt yourself. You've got to go between them. And so that's very important. James, of course, is also the brother of Jesus, and the twin in many respects. And James is the alter ego of Ian Fleming on the page. And Bond is a covenant, a testament. So it may be that there are multiple levels at play in the name James Bond. But we'll never know for sure, because Ian Fleming destroyed any papers that he'd used when he was researching them and creating these names anyway. So, and he never let on, and he never gave anybody a straight answer.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Well, you just brought up so many things I would love to ask about, and one of them is the about Solomon's Temple. And and in your book, Gnosis, The Secret of Solomon's Temple Revealed, you speak about... Well, why don't you tell us more about what is the true temple, which I know what you're going to say. What is that?
Everybody stand up and find a mirror. And then you'll find it. You don't need to go and dig into Jerusalem to find it, because you won't find it there anyway. But Solomon's Temple is very, very interesting, and this is a few years ago now, so I'm going to have to pull on some of these grey cells in my brain. But Solomon and Sheba are very important to this, because, you know, Solomon is supposed to be this great wise man, but he is also a very fiery man, something that James Bond is claimed to be in the Bond novels. And Sheba is the Queen of Serpents. You know, dragons and serpents yet again. And she is the wise one. She is the Sophia, the watery wisdom. Just like one of the Bond girls in one of the Bond novels is claimed to be watery to James Bond's fire. These are the two symbols of the opposites. And Solomon and Sheba come together. And only then is that union fulfilled and they have a child. And this whole story is exactly the same story that Ian Fleming uses in the Bond Code. It's the union of the opposites and the creation of the true temple. And that true temple, of course, is our own mind. We must enter in and discover the true self, which is the divinity within us. Something that has been hidden over the 2,000 years since then by various people, because it's heresy to the Catholic Church and to the powers that be. You cannot say that the divinity is within and that you don't need to pay the priest, because that undermines their power base. And so these things were hidden. As Carl Jung pointed out, gnosis was hidden within alchemy because the language and symbolism of alchemy totally confused anybody else, and the church missed it completely. So it was kept alive within that. And within the tales such as Arthur and Guinevere, Guinevere, of course, meaning Queen of Serpents, yet again, Arthur is Pendragon, head dragon. So we're seeing a little bit of a pattern developing here of the union of the opposites and serpents and dragons being used.
Certainly enlightenment requires that we bring up the energy from to our wonderful body. And you do speak to the energy called the Kundalini.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll just end up by saying it comes up to two temples through the left and right brain and enters into the center of the dove, where the pineal and the pituitary operate in the divine marriage. And that's all I'll say about that. And why don't you tell us about the Kundalini, which is such a strong, wonderful symbol and metaphor.
It's an incredible one, and it's something, you know, that I've written a lot about and spoken to a lot of people about, including, and not a lot of people like it, but including scientists, because they need to be brought into this as well, because if there's truth to it, you know, then we should be able to do the old Rosicrucian thing and find the nature of it. The concept was obviously Hindu in origin, or in some people's eyes, it goes back even further than that and right back into Africa, which is a possibility, especially as the oldest surviving ritualistic and religious artifacts that we have on the planet are in Africa, and they are serpent-related, and they go way back 5,000 years before Christ. The Kundalini is the concept of the rising and lowering serpent energy, twin serpent energies, which are perceived to be going up and down the spine from the base chakra. Unfortunately, Hinduism didn't give us strict, definite numbers of these things, which is why you often read that there are seven or there are nine or various different numbers. When you're actually getting back to original texts, rather than things that we can read on the internet about the Kundalini, you don't actually find numbers, too many numbers given. So a lot of what's on the internet is fairly modern, but you have to get back to the oldest that you can possibly find to discover that the numbers really don't matter, and that they are part and parcel of who you are at that particular time. So you raise it through various elements of yourself, and those relate entirely to where you are in life, if you know what I mean. You know, some people may be at the base starting point, and other people's may be born way beyond that. And the symbolism of these, of course, were serpents. And once unified and once coming together, once crossing over at various points, you get that incredible neutral place, which is the place of enlightenment, in neutrality, not in being left or right or, you know, Republican or Democrat. It's in being neutral. And it relates, the beauty of this to me is that it relates to everything you can possibly imagine in life.
It truly is a wonderful balancing and actually joining in the Shushumna, which is the central column.
Yeah.
And it's all about initiation, like you say, through levels of consciousness. And so we're really, should we decide to, should we accept the mission, we can take the hero's journey, which is what Bond has done. He's accepted, you know, to deal with his fears.
Absolutely. You know, Ian Fleming points out that this is a neutral character, which is an incredible statement to make. And as if we were in any doubt that he is enacting the ancient gnosis, the knowledge of this balance, Ian Fleming actually claims that James Bond is Manichaean, which is somebody who follows Mani, who was an early Gnostic. So, you know, that's an incredible statement that's just completely missed by all the biographers, which amazed me. He even gives James Bond a reason to get out of the fact that he has to kill. Even though, you know, if you read this on the correct level, it's symbolic. It gives him a really good religious reason and claims that he went to a Calvinist school, which in a Calvinist school, you can basically do whatever it is you want and you'll still be saved because you're preordained. So
it's about addressing the fear and conquering or killing the fear. So it's all a metaphor. I mean, you know, not to take it literally.
Yeah.
And the divine feminine is there, you know, if we should really look very closely, because many women would say, oh, boy, I don't see it at all. But, again, it's a metaphor.
Yes, if you watch the films, you're going to see an awful lot of sexism and you know, all the usual.
Well, the divine feminine is about our intuition and,
yeah,
you know, again, this ability to create and go beyond our fears. Mm. And, you know, to the Shekinah, which is, you know, the married to our godhood. And the Kundalini is the divine feminine. You know, you learn to work with those energies of the serpent Kundalini, and you are able to be in your own godhood.
Yeah.
It's profound.
Did Ian Fleming understand this concept? And that's really interesting to me, because if Ian Fleming understood it, then he would have used the symbol of serpents in the books, and he would have revealed it in other ways. And amazingly, he did. The serpent is found in the Bond novels as the Ouroboros Snake and Bait Company. Worm and Bait Company, sorry. Worm, of course, is another word for snake anyway in etymology. And you know, is the Dr. No uses a dragon and is equated to the slithering serpent. And Noel Coward stayed at Ian Fleming's home, Goldeneye in Jamaica, and was not only disturbed by the barrenness of this almost Cathar place that Ian Fleming had created, but he was disturbed by the number of serpents that were on the walls. So he even had the symbols of these things on the walls in the bedrooms at Goldeneye. So I think that Ian Fleming certainly understood it. And, you know, one of the things that in the Kundalini and the Tantric rites that comes about is this other side, this tantric sexual energy that is spoken of, a way of physically manifesting these symbols. And, yeah, and I also think that Ian Fleming understood that, and especially from his readings of the likes of Aleister Crowley, who wrote extensively on, you know, serpents and all that world that we've just been discussing. And, you know, his friend Kenneth Grant went on and wrote a book called Cults of the Shadow, where he expressed Crowley's belief in unifying these sacred serpents in the sexual act. So people can take things way out of context and physically manifest symbols as well and you know, get very confused. I don't think Ian Fleming in any way helped himself to a great degree with all this, but he certainly understood it. He certainly did not manage to deal with his own self, because he smoked and drank himself to death.
Oh dear. Wow, and I knew that he had problems, and I thought he, you know, it's interesting. Sometimes writing really is a catharsis and helps us to deal with our problems. obviously, it didn't quite work with him then, but wasn't that his attempt? Wouldn't you say that he was trying to use it as therapy?
I would say any writer that writes, like you just said, uses it as therapy for themselves an awful lot of the time. It can be an expression of energy, an expression of ideas. It can be lots of expressions, but it's certainly a working through your own thoughts. And Ian Fleming was doing that, and he spoke to an awful lot of people on mysticism, on religion. You know, he got people to actually light candles in Catholic churches on his behalf and believed that this had actually made an effect. He was grasping after straws. He was trying to find an answer. And with all his knowledge on the codes and the symbols and the world of the esoteric, he still did not manage to attain that point of balance and neutrality that we've been talking about, because, you know, he smoked 70 cigarettes a day, and his doctor said you need to cut these down. So he did. He went down to 60, and he drank a bottle of bourbon a day. And mm-hmm. you know, if anybody
who's trying, it sounds like he was anesthetizing his pain. And so truly, he really didn't have. It's unfortunate when we miss the mark. When we're doing the spiritual work, if we don't have the correct kind of help, and if we get caught up, and again, you mentioned sexuality as part of the avenue to reach these higher heights. However, let me just say something about that, because I would like people not to miss the point here. It's not, there are different ways of activating the Kundalini in a safe manner. And if you get so caught up in the sexual act itself, you are missing really the significance of it. And that's I think, a lot. It's almost like a trap, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
And you can activate the Kundalini a number of ways. And one of them is your breathing. And holotropic breath work is one of the fastest ways to do that, as well as dancing and shamanic ritual using, you know, drums and rattles and activating. Again, the Kundalini sounds, literally, when you activate it, it sounds like a serpent and a rattle. And you feel it literally like waves going through your body. So it's not about the sexual act so much as we have this instrument called the body, and it literally is a pathway to opening the doors to higher consciousness if you use it correctly.
Yes.
And if you're not coming from a place in the heart, your heart chakra must be the central point in which you use these energies. If you get stuck, and again, a lot of the sexual energy can get stuck in the root chakra and the survival level, or the, you know, the second chakra, and that can be a trap.
I couldn't agree more. The
great.
There are several things which are worrying to me about the you know, people jumping on the Kundalini thing, because, you know, I get emails saying, oh, how do I do the Kundalini, and how do I get into the trance?
You get a good teacher.
Absolutely.
Truly. I mean, unless you have a spiritual approach to this, you can fall into so many traps.
Oh, yeah. You know, the first thing that you need to learn is some balance, but you definitely need to get a good teacher. But, you know, you get the likes of people emailing you and saying, you know, I'd really like to go for this. I hear from various books that are out that if I take X drug, or if I go into this sexual act, you know, it's, no, there's no need for any of that. Does the earth do drugs? And come on. It's just
That's another trap,
Way out of balance. There's no need for it, and you are better doing this gradually and slowly, because one thing is damn sure, you're going to take into whatever trance you find, whatever you take with you, and you can find heaven or hell. So, you know, be very, very careful with these things.
And these secret societies sometimes can be part of that trap if, again, depending on the person involved. And, you know, we have good and bad people in these secret societies. I mean, that's a given.
Yeah.
And so it can be used correctly or it can be abused is the problem there. Mm. And you do speak about how it's been used in propaganda and history and manipulating us. You want to go into... We only have a couple of minutes left. What would you like to end on? How would you like to wrap this up?
Well, you know, one thing we've just been saying about secret societies, I think we were just discussing a moment ago with my publisher about what sells best. And I'm not in respect of I would write something that sells well. He was pointing out that secret societies sells an awful lot more than any other books I've written. And to me, I don't want secret societies to be held up as something that we all ought to join. It does not
right.
want to be something that, you know, it's like making a movie about gangsters. We make them appear as heroes, and it's just nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
You must discover yourself. And if you think that that's New Age pap, then think again, because let me put it simply. We can go and watch James Bond film, and we walk out of a James Bond film thinking that we're James Bond. We want the gadgets, we want the cars, we walk with this particular Bond way, and we swell our chest and look all handsome. We're not James Bond, and nobody is James Bond. It comes from the mind of a man who had problems. This is a film. And we do this throughout our entire lives. We take on the cloak of other people. And in this case, it's fiction. So the first thing to do is to get rid of all those clothes that you are wearing that are other people's and find out just who you are. That's the first thing before anybody should start, and not idolize secret societies or any guru or anything in that respect. It's just to discover who you are, take it simple, and remember, you know, whenever a certain trait comes up, is that you or is that somebody else?
Excellent. That's wonderful. And we can, you know, meditate and connect to our own inner guru through, again, activating our higher consciousness.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, it's been such a pleasure, and I want you to be able to share, too, what projects you're going to be doing if you're in the States, or want to give us your website.
Well, the easiest way to get through to me is on, and the easiest website to remember is thebondcode.com, because that links to most of the other websites. What I'm up to right now, I will be shooting off to Norway pretty soon to on a real Indiana Jones trip, where I've got to get on some old plane and land on a glacier, so that's going to be fun. That's to do a film on the Viking serpent, so that's fascinating, and that's going to show an awful lot of stuff about the serpent in old Viking lore. Then I'll be shooting back to the States to make a film about ancient America. So that's going to be fun as well. And I've just completed another book, which will be going off to the publishers soon. So quite a lot. And I've just amazingly won a couple of awards, film awards, for a film I did on Jules Verne, which will be coming out soon. So I'm really pleased on that. So there's such a lot going off. It's a great life, and I'm really enjoying it. But it only came about by leaving that old hamster's wheel behind, discovering my true self, and getting some balance.
Excellent. Well, and you truly are you're crusading these consciousness levels for us, and learning about cults and secret organizations. I really appreciate your knowledge about that.
Well, it's only by people like you that I'm allowed to express it, so thank you.
Well, we didn't get into the Vatican and the Nazi party. I wanted to do that, but maybe another time.
Anytime.
There's so much. There's so much. Thank you, Philip Gardner. Wonderful. And people, you have been listening to Carrie L's HeartLink show with Philip Gardner and myself, Carrie L. And in the next broadcast, we'll be having a very special guest, Michael Cremo, who will be talking about forbidden archaeology. So I'm looking forward to that. So, and it's been a pleasure, Philip. Thank you so much for being on my show, and thank you for listening, everyone. Bye-bye.